Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador and the forthcoming book At War with the Past, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. She also has an article in Monday's New York Times, It's Not About Assange. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anita Isaacs.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you're basically saying that the theater that we've witnessed in London with Julian Assange on Sunday appearing on the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy, somewhat like Evita, and I'm sure it'll become a regular occurrence as he's holed up in that building, and presumably he'll be able to continue to talk to the press from that balcony. You're saying, though, that this has nothing to do with Ecuador and British relations, but it has everything to do with regional and local politics in the Western Hemisphere. And also it has little to do with protecting Mr. Assange's rights to a fair trial or freedom of the press, which Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, has trampled upon at home. So let's begin with the motives of the Ecuador's leader. You're saying he's grandstanding for Western Hemispheric politics?
Yes, he is. I think, if I would amplify on the issue of Britain and Ecuador, I don't think it has anything to do with Britain and Ecuador, but I think Britain does become a piece of the motivations to the extent that it's designed to enable President Correa to gain power and prestige within the region. I say that because Britain and Argentina are still engulfed in a dispute over the Falklands Islands or the Malvinas Islands, as Argentina refers to them. And there have been an increase in aggressive speak and actions in the prelude to the Olympics between the two countries, as this represents the 30th year of the British, what Argentinians view as the British invasion of the Malvinas Islands. So in the context of that dispute and an escalation in rhetoric between Argentina and Britain over Argentina's claims to sovereignty and Prime Minister Cameron's refusal to countenance or dialogue over these issues, Britain has again become seen in Latin America as somewhat of an imperialist power these days.
So
to the extent that Britain represents what Argentinians refer to as a neo-colonial power, it can get easily lumped with the United States in terms of Latin American perceptions of outside powers.
Well, it seems like the British Foreign Secretary didn't help matters by his clumsy threats about invoking a 1987 British act that was in response to the shooting in front of the Libyan embassy. That seems to have that was an extraordinarily clumsy move, was it not?
Yeah, I think that was a clumsy move. But what I think was there are two symbolic moves that I think serve to ratchet up the rhetoric and the tensions between the two countries. On the one hand, there was the decision that Prince William would go and serve 6 weeks of duty in the Falkland Islands earlier this year, which really, it was a sure display of Britain control and, in fact, Britain imperialist control of the islands. And the second was a rather pointed advertisement that Argentinians taped in the prelude to the games that depicted one of their star athletes, the captain of the hockey team, exercising training in the Falkland Islands or the Malvinas, including lifting weights on a war memorial, on a British war memorial in the islands, and it had the caption, "To compete in Britain, we need to train on Argentinian soil." So I think both those symbolic acts were part of the ratcheting up of the rhetoric and the aggression, and they were also symbols that contributed to renewing tensions between the two countries in this year in which there was both the Olympics and the 30th anniversary of the Falklands invasion.
So, Anita Isaacs, you're suggesting then that Ecuador and Argentina are both on the same page vis-a-vis the Malvinas and the sense of British kind of I guess, an imperial reflex. Is that one way to put it?
It's not just Ecuador. I would say that the majority of Latin American countries feel the same way. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Alliance of South American Trading Countries, called Mercosur, earlier this year decided to not allow shipping vessels that bore the Falklands flag to dock at any of their ports.
So again, I'm speaking with Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, and she has an article in Monday's New York Times, It's Not About Assange. Now, it is about WikiLeaks, according to your article in the New York Times, Anita Isaacs, in as much as Correa, the Ecuadorian president, did kick out the American ambassador, expelled the U.S. ambassador, Heather Hodges, based upon confidential cables that were leaked by WikiLeaks that accused Mr. Correa of appointing a corrupt police officer in order to have someone in the post who he could easily manipulate. So undoubtedly, Assange has played a role in this, right?
Yes, he has played a role. But the issue is more one of antagonism towards the United States. It's an antagonism towards the United States that in which it was the content of the cable rather than WikiLeaks per se, and the reaction of the U.S. ambassador rather than anything particularly about the values that WikiLeaks embraces or that Assange purports to embrace of freedom of the press. So yes, there was a confidential cable that was leaked to the press and published in the Spanish newspapers that did precisely what you said, reported, sort of documented the U.S. ambassador noting the levels of corruption and accusing Correa of appointing a corrupt police officer whom he could control to that position. This was a very sensitive issue, as I note there and you've said, given the context of the police mutiny that had occurred in September of 2010, and a whole host of accusations of corruption against the Correa administration, and in particular his dealings with his own brother in the allocation of contracts. So it was particularly irksome to Correa. But second, what was also irksome to Correa was the fact that the ambassador, when given a chance, did not retract her comments, did not apologize, did not show any remorse whatsoever. And that's when he declared her persona non grata. He has a tendency of going after his rivals, being very thin-skinned, going after his rivals, persecuting and prosecuting them, and then at the last minute sort of backing down by saying, if you apologize, if you say this is untrue, it's okay, and trying to smooth over rough waters. She refused to do this, and hence she was expelled, and this remained a raw wound for in Correa's mind, that the issue of that, you know, that by granting asylum to Assange, it's in a sense a way to continue to resolve an issue or to settle a score that remains outstanding, in his view, with the United States.
So, Anita Isaacs, in your New York Times article, It's Not About Assange, you point out that Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, this is not, as Assange has put it, which is that this is about, and he made this appeal to the United States to stop what he says is a witch hunt against WikiLeaks, and he also called upon the United States to stop attacking freedom of the press, and specifically called upon President Obama. So Assange is making it an issue about freedom of the press, but you're arguing here that Rafael Correa, the Ecuadorian president, has trampled upon the press at home. So elaborate on that.
Yeah, he's been one of the worst offenders in terms of curtailing, curbing, and criminalizing, in fact, the press. To understand his motivations for this, for a second, is the fact that he is extremely popular at home, and his party, which is called actually Proud and Sovereign Homeland, which I'm telling, is not really contested by other political parties. So it remains really the dominant political party and in his movement, the dominant political force in Ecuador. The bulk of the opposition as a result has come, as it does in many Latin American countries, somewhat to progressive leaders from the press, which tends to be controlled by conservative elite families. And so he's waged his war, in a sense, with the press. And the press has been relatively unrestrained in its willingness or, you know, to criticize Correa. But in response, he's taken a very heavy-handed attitude towards the press. On the there have been five journalists, I think, arrested and sentenced to prison terms for defamation. He's taken over some 18 or to 20 media outlets. The government has taken over themselves. He has brought lawsuits, two significant lawsuits against journalists for writing a book called Big Brother, which documents corruption in the awarding of government contracts between Correa and his brother Fabio, and has basically bankrupt one of the leading country's leading newspapers, who published an op-ed criticizing Correa for his actions in repressing the police mutiny of September 2010. It's really been a kind of crusade. He's waged a virtual crusade against the press in his country.
So you're saying that he's also grandstanding for attention in South and Central America to become a regional leader, or the leader of the emerging left in Latin America. At this point, I suppose, you're suggesting that Hugo Chavez holds that mantle?
Yes. Hugo Chavez holds that mantle, but his health has been declining. It's unclear. He's had two cancer surgeries. It seems that he has an incurable cancer, weakened politically at home as he faces re-election. He's facing a more difficult election this coming October. But what is also apparent is that he may well be forced to step aside politically in order to take care of his health. And if he does, there doesn't appear to be an obvious carrier of his flame. In fact, it's likely that the opposition will fracture and be engaged in serious infighting. So there's no natural leader or institutions to succeed him. If, you know, with this scenario, it creates an opening for someone else in Latin America to step up to the plate. And I think that I see Correa as vying for that position. It fits his leadership style, which is combatant, populist, leftist, defiant, and it, you know, it also seems to match both his style and Chavez. He sees his policies as closely aligned with those pursued by Chavez, the leftist populist policies. He made a claim to leadership in some ways during the Summit of the Americas in Cartagena, that was held in Cartagena, Colombia, in May of this year, in which he tried to play leader by refusing to attend himself on the summit unless Cuba was invited, and by appealing to other members of the Chavez-founded alliance called the Bolivarian Alliance to follow suit. They didn't follow suit. They went, although Chavez couldn't attend in the end for health reasons, but both Bolivia and Nicaragua, the other two key members, attended the summit. And in a sense, you know, the summit took, you know, quite an aggressive or assertive rather than aggressive attitude towards the United States, both vis-a-vis Cuba and vis-a-vis issues of drugs. And Correa was the only one who didn't go, so he was left at home. And so in a sense it backfired because he couldn't have the kind of influence that he aspired to have. I think that what he's doing now is really, you know, it's like something has dropped on onto his plate from the heavens. And he's not about to forego this opportunity to emerge as the spokesperson for anti-imperialism in the hemisphere.
Well, at that recent summit in Cartagena, President Obama got an earful from a number of Central and South American leaders about the failed war on drugs. And now he's got a new government in Mexico that's probably going to radically change their policy towards the war on drugs. So There's no question that in Latin America, they're pushing. You know, there's nothing we can do in the United States, apparently, about the war on drugs, even though every knowledgeable person says it's a total failure. It appears to be, you know, bureaucratically safe and on some kind of autopilot. So it's probably going to take foreign leaders to get our attention on that, surely.
Yes, I think this is a real source of contention between most of Latin America and the United States. Latin America is really seeking alternative solutions to perceiving the drugs as a war, in fact, and trying to find ways to reduce the violence that is associated with drug trafficking. So they're considering alternative measures from, and there have been a group of presidents of Latin America that have put forward a blueprint to rethink the war on drugs. There have the recently elected president of Guatemala, who the least expected person, given the fact that he is a conservative retired military general who was active in Guatemala's civil war, has in a sense assumed the mantle of leadership on calling for drug legalization, not just of consumption, but even of transportation of drugs. So the mood on drugs is shifted, and the U.S. is not keeping up with that shift. That's one thing, and it's occurring in a context in which Latin America is also far less dependent on the U.S. economically. They've truly diversified their trade relations, and trade with Asia could well soon displace the U.S. in terms of trade with Latin America. The leftist leaders in the region, and indeed others, have also aggressively sought to diversify their political and commercial relations, including relations with Iran. And Korea has been at the forefront of those efforts. And in general, China is really emerging as a principal trading partner and political partner in the region. So there's a lot that's in flux and is changing. And really, until, you know, it's time that the United States wake up, in a sense, and understand that there are real significance to the hemispheric relationship, and that begin to find a way to work constructively with Latin America to resolve problems which are both Latin America's problems and the U.S.'s problems, in the sense that we share a hemisphere.
Well, just in closing then, Anita Isaacs, we've talked about British imperialism and its death rattle, if you will, in this Assange case, and then U.S. Attitude towards U.S. imperialism, if you will, from a Latin American perspective, which Correa is both taking advantage of at this moment. But that's not to say that this is entirely a manufactured issue vis-a-vis Assange. They seem to have had met, did they not? And they had, Correa had an interview with Assange in June of 2012, at which, according to your article in the New York Times, he expressed his anger at the imperialist attitude of the U.S. ambassador. So just in closing, tell us about the relationship between Assange and Correa. After all, Assange seemed to know where to go in terms of skipping bail and hiding out somewhere. He went to the Ecuadorian embassy.
Yes, they had a wonderful interview that one can actually look up on YouTube. It's posted there. And in which it seemed to be a kind of meeting of minds. And it concluded with them both wishing each other well and safety. So it's ironic that WikiLeaks, which in a sense generated the souring of a relationship between the U.S. and Ecuador, which had been really quite cordial prior to that, during the early years of the Correa administration, in part because Correa had been a doctoral student in economics at the University of Illinois and fondly remembered those years, and the U.S. and Ecuador had maintained a productive dialogue. But so it's ironic that the souring of that relationship provoked by the WikiLeaks cable had actually led to the two men finding in each other something that they seem to perceive as making them soulmates. They do have a similar defiant, combative style that maybe they recognize in each other, and they seem to have a common foe in the United States.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Anita Isaacs.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Anita Isaacs, who's a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador and a forthcoming book, At War with the Past, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. She also has an article in Monday's New York Times, It's Not About Assange. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the party, that is the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China.